Good morning, everybody. Feel free to ask me questions in the style that you're asking, Dick. And I want to sort of continue on from what Dick was saying and think about how you look at past history from DNA data. Given a sort of configuration, what can you say back in time? And I want to sort of describe some sort of recent work that's been going on that people have used to try and find ways of dealing with going back in time. And these are just some of the collaborators that I've worked with. I've been fortunate in having some very good people to work with and some very good students at Oxford. I just wanted to review very briefly what Dick said, so this will be a sort of quick review rather than trying to explain it all again. Dick was talking about the Wright-Fisher model, where you have a population of M genes and generation K plus one is formed from generation K by choosing M genes at random with replacement. This is the sort of vanilla version of this, and in general you have mutations which also can appear to the lines as you go down in time here. My time always goes downwards, and that's the way I like to draw trees and various things. And you can see here the idea of a tree coming from the Wright-Fisher model, in the sense that these two here have a common ancestor. And if you thought about it, when you went back in time, there'd be a tree for any group of genes that you chose. So if you chose N genes, little n genes here, you could trace back their ancestry and you would have a common ancestor back eventually. It wouldn't be a binary tree, because you could actually have, say, three individuals which have the same parent in the prior generation. When you had a large population size, you can believe that most of the coalescences are just binary, and you have a very tiny probability that you have three joining together or more than that. So that's the coalescent limit from the Wright-Fisher model. This has been formalised. I think other people knew about this beforehand, but Kingman made a very formal paper here called The Coalescent. And it's a very, very famous paper. It's been quoted by many people in biology, describing this coalescent process here. And the idea, as Dick was saying last time here, was that if time is measured in units of M generations, so my M here is like Dick's 2N, if you want. I'm just going to have one symbol for the number of genes rather than fuss with the diploids. But the 2N is very common in a lot of papers that you do read, so you should be aware of it, and it's very easy to get a factor of two wrong in this subject, as it probably is in physics and everything else, I imagine. These sort of factors and constants are hard to get right, surprisingly, for mathematicians. Okay, so we get a coalescent tree here, and the coalescent tree is binary, and you can believe that there's a coalescent tree for any sample, but you can believe that there's a sort of big coalescent tree here for the whole population. I want to say something about that as well. And the coalescence here comes from the name that you join together. That's simply the coalescence name in this. So in the timescale of M generations, so a generation is not a year, of course, it's 15 or 20 years for humans, and as you go back in time, the time is in units of M generations, but sometimes you want to know this in real time units as well, of course. You have to convert correctly then by knowing the generation time of, say, humans or chimpanzees or Drosophila, heaven forbid. I don't know what the generation time of Drosophila is. What is the generation time of Drosophila?
It varies. Well, in nature, it's a lot different than in the lab.
But what sort of order of magnitude is it?
10 days to a month.
10 days, see? So Drosophila have got 10 days to a month. And humans are 15 to 20 years, depending on what you think.
In modern humans, it's like 25 years.
Okay, so that's interesting. Mm. So that's an important sort of
factor. It also varies between mitochondrial DNA and the Y.
Right.
It's maybe just over 20 for mitochondrial and 30 for the Y.
So for real biology, it's important, these sort of facts are important. And to convert to really is important. For a mathematician, it's often convenient just to work in these time scales where you've got rid of time and put it into coalescent time units. So in coalescent time units here, in units of m generations, the rate of coalescence here is j choose 2 when you've got j lines here in the coalescent tree. So if you look across section here with j lines, then the rate at which they'd coalesce in this continuous time scale would be j choose 2. It's a rate of 1 per unordered pair joining together. So that's a nice sort of mathematical description of it. But as I said, if you're a biologist and you can looking at things in real years, it's very, very important to get that kind of idea of what the generation time really is. Right. Here's a coalescent tree of 1,000 here. And it's worth thinking a bit about what's happening here. If you look at it down the bottom here, there are many, many coalescences here, so thick, in fact, that they're almost undifferentiated. And as you go back in time here, what happens is that you're joining together. And in fact, the mean time here is about 2 from the top to the bottom. It's different from a branching process kind of a tree. So in branching processes, if you're describing a tree forward in time, it just sort of grows forever, or maybe it dies out or something. But these trees are different from branching process trees because of this constant population size that they come from. It's a different kind of behavior. So I say this to everybody when I try and describe them, because people naturally think that they're something like a branching process, but they're different. There's correlation between the lineages here. It's a different kind of process. And it's a quadratic rate here of coalescence, where it's linear in branching processes. So it has a different behavior. And there are many, many coalescences at the bottom of the tree here. And finally, it's about 2 units from here to here. Dick was saying this. And the last time unit here is about 1 time unit. So most of the time is spent with very, very few ancestors in this tree. This has a lot of biological consequences. It means, if you believe this model, that if you looked at a group of individuals or a whole population and went back in time and watched how things coalesce, then the sort of ancestry is determined very much by these few individuals. Everything is coalescing at a very rapid rate here. And so if you believe neutrality and everything about the model and random mating, which of course is not exactly right, then you would go back in time, but there's a lot of sort of action here in the current time, and the deep ancestry is determined by very, very few lines in these processes. So that's an interesting feature about it. Now, if you take a coalescent tree like this, what guarantee have you actually got that you've got a common ancestor in this? Well, you do have a guarantee, because the rate here is actually quadratic, and in this process here, the quadratic rate of coalescence is so fast that you could actually start this off at infinity. So technically, you could have an entrance boundary at infinity here, and in any sort of epsilon of time, you'd be down to a finite number of lines, and then you just progress with this finite number of lines. But you can jump in from infinity.
So like infinity that. Is little n, as of yesterday.
Infinity is big n, in fact.
Well, that was the question.
Yeah, infinity is big n. It's the whole population. So you're thinking of the whole population. It's not clear that if you let little n tend to infinity, then that's the same as starting off with a big n and tending to infinity. But it is. It works out all right. It's a very well-behaved process, in fact. It works out nicely. But this quadratic rate ensures you can jump in from this infinite number of lines here, individuals. And it's very sort of, it's good to think about it in that way for the whole population. You can actually think that, you could actually think of the tree being generated in this direction as well. There are sort of ways to think of that. So the way it sort of works is everything's uniform, in a sense. So you can do a lot of combinatorics coming down that direction, all going about in that direction. You don't always have to go that direction. I mean, branching process people naturally think in this direction. But population genetics usually goes back sometimes that direction when you're doing sort of math calculations. And when you look in here, one of the sort of ways of coming down here is saying that if you've got three lineages here, then each one of them is equally likely to branch. And so you just actually, if you're going to generate this tree with no mutations and everything, simplest case, you just keep branching and branching and branching and branching like that, where you're choosing one individual at random to branch like that. And then that sort of gives you a coalescent tree. If you kept going forever, you'd have the infinite coalescent tree. Like that. Yeah.
So when people look at these trees, they often ask, what is the time for the most recent common ancestor?
Yes.
And maybe attach a lot of significance to that.
Yes.
But do you think that you could, it would be useful to ask about maybe the time to half of the coalescence?
Yes. So Chris's point is here that it's more sort of in some sense robust. These last individuals are just sort of wandering around the globe before they mate, in a long sort of history going back. And you shouldn't sort of attach too much significance to these few individuals here, because if you had one bit of DNA here, it's going to have a different time to the ancestor and a different lot of ancestors from another bit of DNA here. Because there might be different chromosomes or recombination or stuff like this. So it's sort of important to not think that the guy here is a sort of atom of the human race, as one atom of the human race. But there's a lot of atoms in this. So that's just some sort of points about that.
Yep. Is it just the illusion of this time to common ancestor?
Okay, yes, it's a well-known distribution here, so it's like a distribution in a death process, in a sense. So you've got these sort of quadratic rates, and you can write it down explicitly. It's easy enough to do. It's been around for a long, long while. And the way you do it, so if you think about, if you're starting off from sort of N individuals and you want to go back in time here, and you want to ask, what's the time to the ancestor? Well, this is just a regular death process here. If you think that lines are lost by death, so you lose one line when you coalesce, because you're just counting number of edges in the tree. So you think about counting the edges in the tree, starting with N, and you go to N minus 1 to N minus 2, and finally you go from 2 to 1, like that. And so it's just actually, if you're thinking about, I think I'll go on the next slide, because this explains this. Yeah. That's a natural first. Next, what happened there? Okay, that's the one I wanted to get here. So that's a very natural, I missed this one out in fact. This is a natural sort of question, is what is this distribution of time to the ancestor? And so if you think about it here, what I'm saying here is the rates are actually going to be these quadratic rates here of coalescing. So you can think about these times here. There's a time T5 while there's five edges in the tree, another time T4 while there's four edges, T3 while there's three edges, T2 while there's two edges, and finally here you get to this ancestor here. So in fact the distribution of the time from here to here is the sum of it's T5 plus T4 dot 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 plus T2, where these are exponential random variables with rates of J choose 2. In other words, their means are 1 on J choose 2, or the rates of J choose 2. And so that distribution of the sum of the exponential random variables is known. It's got a series density. It's easy enough to do. A lot of people have done that. I hesitate to write it out, it's a bit messy.
Is it exponential itself?
No, it's not exponential itself, no. It's a series of exponential
right,
terms of quadratic things.
What tails are distributions? Intuitively.
Yeah, so the tails would be like e to the minus, the eigenfunction, the eigenvalues of it end up as e to the minus a half n minus 1 t, they're the eigenvalues. So it's a series in these times of terms here where n is 2, 3, 4, and so on. So the first order of magnitude which determines the tails here, the time, is like e to the minus t, in fact. But then the other bits are quadratic as you go out. And the probability that you've got j, the probability that you've got sort of j ancestors at time t back has a leading term which is like e to the minus half j, j minus 1 t. So that's what's determining sort of the number of ancestors as you go back. It's a very fast kind of rate back, just quadratic. Right. So these are the eigen values of this death process, in fact, which determine the transition probabilities and the time to the ancestor. Does that answer that?
Yeah. If you go back to that Wright Fisher model and you have two different lineages, then you would ask which one survives to have all the ancestors and which one dies out. Are these probabilities known?
You're starting one you just actually joined together.
Well, let's say there was one of them has just split, but then there's another lineage which will eventually die out and not have further descendants.
Oh, you're thinking coming down in a forward direction.
Exactly, because you're just coming down.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've got a formal question. I don't understand the question so much. Yeah.
I guess the question is. If you have a given population size, you have one.
Some are lost.
Some of the individuals.
Some of the individuals are lost. That's right. Yes.
Do you know, for example, the distribution of time before an individual loses all its descendants? An individual eventually has no descendants is one.
Possibly we do, but I can't think of that here. I don't know. Is that easy, Dick? I'm not sure. You can do it very easy. You can write down the sort of distribution of it, because you know.
The time of loss
of it. It's known, I think. Yeah. It's not something I've got in my head easily, because I'd think always backwards. But yeah, I think it's known. I'm sure you could do that, but I don't know explicitly. I mean, it's just actually. The chance you die. So you die with probably. Yeah, you don't reproduce with probably one. But you've got to have at least one offspring, the probability you have at least it's fairly complicated, I think.
If you condition on being not having eventually dying out, which is the most likely thing, you get one answer. If you don't have any conditioning as a definite, and you condition on it actually being the old ancestor because it's over. It's two random fellows. So I think it's something like two large manners.
It's an inclusion-exclusion kind of problem, isn't it? Yeah, I haven't got it in my head, but I think it's doable or probably known. I don't have my head that way. Yeah, so that's really what Dick was saying there, and that's the tree of 1,000. But it is important to know that you can actually jump in at infinity and think you can go back. So then the thing is to think what happens when you've got mutations in a tree here. So we're working up towards a more realistic model here that you've got coalescence again as occurring at this rate of k choose 2 and k edges, we just said that, and you think that mutations occur at a rate of theta on 2 on the edges of the coalescent tree in a coalescent timescale according to a Poisson process, given the edge lengths to the tree. So the theta here is a sort of rescaled mutation rate from the Wright Fisher model. So theta would be 2mu here in this context. And this is what the geneticists would say. Theta is 2mu here, where in the Wright Fisher model, you're thinking that when you reproduce and one guy goes like here, it could actually change here with the probability u, or not change with the probability 1 minus u. And then the scaling is such that you're actually keeping that quantity fixed. And the 2 is from convention. It's not from diploids. It's just the convention that makes things work out nicely. And it's sort of a convention that's been carried through for many, many years. It's not, the 2 is not because of diploids, it's just some other problem. So the easiest thing here is to make it fairly general here and think about that you've got some sort of type space here for these genes. You could have a type space, say 1, 2 to D, and you could think of these lines here as representing DNA sequences, and there are various models of mutation that I want to come to. But the nice thing is to think about it quite generally, so you're actually thinking of a general sort of Markov transition of types here. But I have in my mind that there could be different sort of scenarios that one's thinking about for mutation. Could be for sequences like Dick was thinking, or it could be other kinds of scenes. And it doesn't actually have to be countable like this. It could actually be uncountable. It could be a general type space here. But the easy one is nice to think about, where you've just got a type change by mutation from a parent to an offspring, according to some transition matrix P.
And is that the significance of the colours there?
That's the significance of the colours here. So you're thinking of them as colours, in fact. And that's a nice way to think that you've got sort of coloured dots on a coalescent tree. And they're just occurring according to a Poisson process. You just actually, if you fix the edges links, you've got a Poisson process of dots on this tree. So you can put the dots down, and how would the types be determined by the dots? So the dots don't have to have types to start. You just put them down on the process without colouring them at all. But then the colouring comes from the top. You'd choose an ancestor here of one given type, and then you'd have to think that there was a mutation from this ancestral type. In a sense, this should have a line that goes up, which is the ancestor, which has one sort of coloured dot on it as an ancestor colour. So there is an ancestor colour here that starts this off. So suppose there was a purple one up here. Suppose there was a light green one up here, like my pointer. Then you'd have to change from my light green to this colour here. Then you'd have to change from that colour to that colour. So you could actually think that the edges are coloured if you want. You could colour the edges. So you could colour the edges from the top here, say light green down to here. Then you could colour the edge from here to here as that olive colour. And you could colour the edges red from here to here and so on. So you're thinking of the lineages as sort of coloured, according to what the mutation was in this. And it's this Markov chain of colouring down the tree from the ancestor to the leaves, like that. If you thought of the whole sort of population, so you could think then that if this was just a D-dimensional part space here, you could think that you could characterize all the individuals at the leaves of the tree as being of certain types, and that would be the population, in fact. So if you do that, you get a diffusion process, actually, for the population coming forward in time. So you could think about it just from a tree, but you could think about it as a sort of Wright-Fisher model, if you like. You've got types in this Wright-Fisher model. So you have sort of mutations here between types as they go down, and you're rescaling time in units of M generations, so you're making it continuous, sort of squashing up the boxes in a very long time scale and letting it go down. And you've got this population, and you can categorise the individuals in the population here as being any one of D types, like that. And if you do that, then the sort of relative frequencies of the types in these populations, Wright-Fisher model, going down in time, is a diffusion process. And that's the generator, the backward generator of the diffusion process in that way. So that's the easiest way to think about it. And the infinitesimal variance here that you get here is a typical multinomial sampling variance. So that comes from the multinomial sampling that you're doing here in the direction going down in the Wright-Fisher model. And this bit here, the change here from the drift, comes from the mutation term here. This is the rate matrix for mutation changes here. So this is related here to the infinitesimal mean change here, 2 type J. This way. So, yeah. What's R?
In the
R,
blank comparator.
Right? This R here.
Yeah, right, but where it is in a...
Here. Okay, so ask me some questions about this. Everybody happy with a backward diffusion generator? Yeah. So this kind of approach goes way back to Kimura in the 1950s. It's not anything that's been dreamed up in recent years. This is basically how theoretical kind of population genetics would have started, with a Wright-Fisher model and showing that there was no coalescent process in the 1950s. It was not the way you thought about things. And so a very natural way to think about things would be to say that you have a process, say a diffusion process, and if you want to know the distribution of your sample of n, what's the configuration of types in your sample of n, you would say that you came along and you sampled from this diffusion process and you worked out the distribution of your types. And the population was random, it could have come from this diffusion. That's a natural way to do it. It's only in recent years that it's been a change of emphasis from, and a good change of emphasis from, the coalescent to say that, well, the guys in the sample are really determined by a coalescent process, and it's the ancestry that's actually determining a configuration. But that was not the way it was in Kimura's day. It would have started from diffusion processes in that way. So you can also think, actually, of... Yeah.
It's a very small n in this expression.
There's no small n in this. This is the whole population. The relative frequencies in the whole population. And to get... So to actually, it'll be clear in the next slide. Yeah.
In case greater than or equal to n, right?
Sorry.
D, small d?
There's no n's in it anymore. No. There's no n's in it anymore. It'll become clear in the next... it'll become clear in the next slide. It'll become very clear in the next slide. But, see, one of the important things is to think about what this diffusion is. And so I like to actually think of this diffusion as sort of a big coalescent tree kind of thing. And I think that's a good practical way to actually think about it. So if you think at time sort of T is naught in the diffusion, like this, what you're doing if you're coming along at time T, this is the whole population here. It's all the population down the bottom here, which has this infinite leaf coalescent tree. So we've got sort of an infinite number of leaves here. There's an infinity of leaves here. And you've got it sort of going up like this. And then maybe you're jumping in here to infinity. But very soon you've got, what's Mark doing on? You've got other sort of bits here joining on. And you jump in at infinity here. And as soon as you start back in time, there's a finite number of individuals just back at any time instant here. And you're categorising here, there are mutations here. So there's only a finite number of lines which go back to this original time here, like this. In the diffusion process, you don't start off with one individual. You still start off with an infinite number of individuals here. And they have some sort of initial distribution, say x naught, which is say x one naught in this case to x d naught, and then they'd have some sort of fixed distribution at time naught. In a diffusion process, it always starts like that, with some sort of fixed initial distribution, and then you just, it's continuous sample paths coming down. But you can think about it like this tree, you can see coming down in time here, until you actually hit the bottom here. And when you hit the bottom here, these mutations here are determining what your sort of type is, coming as Markov transitions from the types in the initial states here. and you're categorizing it here into sort of these ones here. You might have so you might have sort of relative frequencies of types here. So these guys might be purple, this might be purple, this might be green, this might be, these ones might be red here. And these are the sort of different frequencies here, say of X1, X2, X3, one loss of colour, X4. So they're the relative frequencies in the population. So it's nice to sort of think of this process here. It's a diffusion process, all right, but it's got this sort of particle construction underneath. And it wouldn't surprise me if physics people are quite familiar with this idea of a sort of particle construction which lives underneath the diffusion process in other sort of contexts.
Why is there no one over the effective population size?
That's all gone because it's become a limit. Time is measured in units of M generations, so that's gone.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not in your generation time. This is in scaled time. Yeah, it's in units of M generation. So we've got rid of M, at least in a mathematical sense. M's still there. So to a biologist, M is important, and the generation time is important.
So the 1 over M is a relative strength of the diffusion versus this transport term. So isn't there something rescaling invariant there?
The theta is the thing that's done this. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So yeah.
It is a constrained diffusive process, right?
So it's in simplex, yeah. It lives in the simplex. So
sum is equal to 1.
Yeah, that's right, that's important. The X is summed to 1 in this. Yes. And the easiest case would be just when you actually had two things. So if you just have two types here, you can It's much easier, and the classic one, we'll see if we can write that down. If you've got, so you don't really have to, it's sort of singular the way it's written here, but it's nice to keep the symmetry. If you want in this, you can just really sum where I and J go from 1 to D minus 1, and then substitute the D term as 1 minus the other terms. It's still a perfectly good generator, it works the same way. It doesn't really matter how you do that. But this is nice in its symmetry.
That's really interesting because the way you drew that picture, that the fixed population size constraint has disappeared. Right? The fixed population size is reintroduced, right? So the invisible
yes.
in the picture by the fact that your D
You're right.
type is completely determined. Which somehow suggests that if D is very large, then there should be a good description of this process which would neglect the constraint.
Yes, that's a point, in fact, yes. This, in some sense, just picks out the backbone of the ancestry. And so you don't actually see everything here. So there are other guys in here which you're not seeing going back. So there's whole bits in here that have sort of died coming down that you're not seeing in that. That's your point. That's true. D itself is not a big deal in a sense. You could have an infinite state space or other things. It's just the diffusion becomes much more complicated. So you can have even uncountable type spaces, in which case you have to go to a measure value diffusion. So you could think of this in some sense as a sort of random measure because the x's add to 1. So it's really a sort of, you could put it in the framework of a sort of measure value diffusion if you want by just the measure would have atoms at x1 to xd. A more very general type space which is uncountable, and you do get these, would get into a measure value diffusion thing. But away from the measure value one, if you just go back to the very, very simplest case here, when you've just got two types, and then you get very classical things. So if D is actually equal to 2, what happens here? Well, usually when D is 2, you'd have a sort of X1, which you'd write as X, and you drive an x2, which is 1 minus x in that case. And you wouldn't usually, in that case, sum over all I and j belong to E. You just really take one of the variables there. And so you'd really look at sort of x1, t, as your diffusion process in that case. And if you're looking at x1, t here, the generator L would be much, not much sort of easier. It's a half x1 minus x d2 by the x squared plus this other linear term here. And if I can get this right, this, you only need the x1 term here. So this would be a term d by the x, and I only have to put in the sort of x1 term here. So that would be sort of like x1, which would be x, times... what have I got? I've got to go to 1 here. So x2, I've got to go x1. I've got to go x2, which is 1 minus x1, 1 minus x here, two, 1, haven't I? Now we've got to do something else here. Plus the other one. Plus x. Thanks, 1, 2. No, I haven't got to put both things here. I've only got to put one. See, this generator works here. The generator is still true if I summed here just I and J went from 1 to D minus 1. It's still a great generator.
I know. I'm just saying that the dx2 has a minus sign because it's not minus x. Must be stable to have x equal 1 half. So there should be a minus sign.
In where?
The first.
Here?
Yeah, because dx...
No. Oh, here, you think? Oh, okay, because of the... No, but the derivatives...
Yeah,
no, I've only got one derivative term. I'm only having an x1 here. That's the only term I've got here. No, that's okay, I think.
But there should be 1 minus 2x. It's a 1 half of the fixed.
Oh, sorry, this thing... I think I've got it right, isn't it? You don't think I've got it right. Sorry. I'm not doing this right. This term here is d by dx. Let me check and see what I think. So there's only one term here, which is d by dx1 effectively here. That's the only term in what I'm trying to write down. It's d by dx1. There's no d by dx2 in it.
But he says d by dx2 is minus.
Yeah, but there's no d by dx2 in it, see? Because I'm not writing down this whole equation. What I'm doing is writing down a sort of equation here that really goes from I and j go from 1 to d minus 1, which in this case is 1. It's the same generator. This is the point. No, I'm right.
R1 is equal to R12.
Sorry?
R21 is equal to R12. Then, yeah, x equal to 1 half is stable.
Yeah, I know I'm going to get in trouble here.
Because like for the second term, you would have a d by dx2, you convert it.
No, but I'm not doing that. That's not what I'm doing.
Isn't this related to the fact that the constraint is to be on the simplex?
Yeah.
So you really only have one degree of freedom instead of
Yeah,
two.
That's exactly right.
That's why it gets a little complicated when we're summing over. All the variables because that doesn't take into account that we have this constraint. So
yeah, I'm going to get this wrong. I'm not going to proceed with that. So there's a linear term here. I think we're both not understanding each other entirely. But okay.
Another question about this.
Yeah.
I might often think it was d by xj sitting to the left of this xi times r and j, rather than to the right.
in that there might be.
Because it's a backward, it's a backward.
Oh, it's the adjoint.
It's the
oh, this is not the forward equation. This is a backward equation. If you want the forward equation, you've got to put this stuff over here, and you've got to put this stuff over here, and you put a minus sign. That's the forward equation.
Okay.
Yeah. But I hope people get this point here, that you don't actually have to sum. Maybe you do need the extra term here. Yeah, that's the point people are trying to make, isn't it? But this J here really only needs to go from 1 to d minus 1, and this I and j really only need to go from 1 to d minus 1. But yes, this term does need to do everything, so there's another term I haven't got here. That's your point.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So in this formulation, your gene space is completely homogeneous, right? So all transitions are allowed and equiprobable. Right?
They're not equiprobable. They're determined by this Markov property.
Originally, in this mutation picture.
The mutations themselves arise just at random, yeah.
Right.
But the actual types, there is a Markov transition of types.
So now if I put some structure in mutations, so it will be not
in what way?
Hypercube.
That could come in the P.
But something else.
Yeah.
Structure will remain, right?
Yeah.
This Fokker-Planck operator will look this I'll get kind of graph,
I think,
which is more interesting, right?
It occurs in the P, I think. In that case, you'd factor that into the P, the way it happened, I think. Yeah.
So you won't get any. Well, in those summations, all summations will be allowed? Or?
Well, it's this one here. It'd be determined by that. You still have this Wright-Fisher kind of structure here. You could have sort of subpopulations, which you might be thinking about. Yeah. I think it's in the mutations, you're saying, if you want a different kind of. So the objects, yes, can be very general. But if you want, I think it occurs in this. Actually, I think
putting just one constant. So if I have, No,
it's not a constant. It's a matrix. It's
okay.
A matrix.
Okay.
See, so this determines your type changes. Yeah,
sorry.
I think it works. Yeah.
Okay. Fine.
Okay. So coming to this sort of sampling distribution, I hope this sort of answers your question a bit. I hope this answers your question, the sampling. This is a sort of somewhat sort of natural way to actually think about how you would do the sampling before the coalescent sort of idea. And this is probably the way Kimura and other people would have thought about it, and Wright, I guess, and Fisher. If you just sample here, you're getting a sort of multinomial distribution here for the sample. If you condition on the population frequencies, then you've got to take the expectation here. Now, one of the important points here is that if P is a sort of a recurrent matrix so that it's ergodic, then you can actually, there's a stationary distribution in these mutation models. That's a big difference from things like Gaussian processes generally. So in genetics, that's a very, very important feature, that you actually have stationary distributions in the diffusion process. So if you let time go to infinity, you have sort of mutations coming in and out, and if P was a ergodic kind of matrix, so everything was working fine, you would be able to get a stationary distribution for it. And people often think about that if you come along in a population, perhaps it's in some sort of stationary distribution, and that's what you're sampling from here. The stationary distribution here, when you've got a general PIJ, is unknown. That's a big unsolved problem in genetics. It's hard. So many people would have tried this for a general PIJ. That's very hard to actually get anything. It's probably a mess to get the general stationary distribution. We'd like to know that, because that tells you about what the probability would be of seeing a given configuration in a proper genetic sense. So then you could do sort of estimation of parameters and various other things. This is the easiest model I'm describing without mutation, but there are selection models and all sorts of things as well. This is about the easiest one. But we still cannot write down what P of N is in this model. We don't know. And we don't know the stationary distribution in this diffusion. We only know it for very explicit cases of P, some simple cases. So what do we know in this? We know that if we've got, say, Pij, is this sort of parent-independent case, is Pj, like that, only depending on where you go to, not a terribly realistic case, then we can write down the stationary distribution of the diffusion. And it's actually Dirichlet. So if you put epsilon j is, say, theta pj, then the stationary distribution of the diffusion is Dirichlet. It's just x1 to epsilon 1 minus 1, xd to epsilon d minus 1 times a constant here. So that's the density here in the stationary distribution of the diffusion under that model, under that particular model. You can do a general model when you've only got two variables, because you can always sort of fit the general case into this kind of model for two variables. So the two variable case is sort of like a two-dimensional Dirichlet, which is really a beta distribution in one of the variables. So that's sort of well known here, and I think Wright knew this. Wright knew this way back.
So if we interpret this as being one site, and then D is false because of four bases.
Yeah, you can have four bases.
And your model there is like the Pj is the equilibrium frequency of the four bases, right?
Yeah.
Now, are you saying that we can't do that then for something like the HKY model? So you know the HKY model, which is the alphas and the betas.
No, you don't. We don't know the answer to that. That's one big sort of unsolved question. A lot of people have tried that. It's quite hard, and you're welcome to try that problem. It's a difficult. It seems as though it's plausible that you might get it out, but it's a mess.
For a general mutation matrix, there has to be a stationary state with detailed balance.
Oh, there is. No, there's no detailed balance in it. No.
So it's
not reversible. No.
It's not surprising that it's a mess.
It's not surprising it's a mess. I agree. It's not surprising it's a mess, but it is a mess. We'd still like to know it. There's no detailed balance. The only reversible case is this case. It's known that this is the only reversible case in this case, and it is reversible.
All the models in phylogenetics are reversible in, I'm not sure if it's the same sense, but they're reversible in the sense that there is detailed balance.
Not this one, then.
But the mutation process is what the phylogeneticists call reversible, which is, you know, the probability of being in one state and the rate of going to somewhere else is...
Yes, I know what you mean. Yes. Now, if life was fair, then if P was reversible, then you might think that the diffusion process would be reversible, but it's not.
So that's what I don't understand, whether the diffusion process is reversible.
Well, you've got a detailed balance equation, or you can the distribution of paths back in time. If you started off in a stationary state, the paths back in time have the same distribution as the paths forward in time.
So that's some condition on L.
Sorry?
That's some condition on L.
Yes, it's some adjoint condition on L.
So that means the forward equation that coincides with the backward equation.
Do you have some other situation solved, like when a state space is a T? Directional T.
Yes, I like these geometric questions, but I don't know the answer. No, there's no solved ones. No. You can have some very interesting geometry questions in this, yes. But they're not well explored, because people tend to think about it in more sort of genetic kind of terms.
Because they're not relevant?
Oh, no, not
difficult.
No, well, they're thinking about sort of real genetics, you know, so they're not thinking about geometry so much. But,
well, but when you consider this type of model.
Oh, yeah. The geometry is a very interesting question, yes. Yeah. It's a nice question.
Anything known about the rate of convergence to this?
You can do things about this. I mean, you can work out the eigen values. They're sort of like quadratic kind of things, a little bit different. The quadratic was a linear term. Yeah.
Didn't basically ask a question about the infinite, what would be called an infinite allele model, basically when this diffusion process, when mutations are...
I haven't answered it. Well, I don't know whether that was a specific question. I think it was more general. Yeah. I think it was more general than that.
If you want the diffusion to happen...
That's one example. That's
On a better lattice, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
So that would be infinitely long. The diffusions never reverse themselves.
That would be sort of a triangular kind of lattice idea, yes. But so what you're referring to, so what he's saying here is you can actually have a model where it's an infinite state space, but every mutation's new. So every color dot is a new dot. Basically. And that's well worked through. That's a sort of limit case of this example here. So it's nice to get this as a sort of limit case of this example here, because in this case here, if you let d tend to infinity, but kept the sum of the epsilons fixed as it is at theta, then you get to a case where you've got a really infinite sort of number of things. But
it's not exactly this.
No, it's a limit of this. It's a limit of that.
No, I think it's...
No, it is.
When Pij... I'm not talking about Pij equal to Pj.
Yeah, I know.
But I still want to have a structure.
I think his question is more general than what you're thinking about. I think it's a more general question that's interesting. But your example here is interesting, what you say. So... we haven't sort of got to this, but if you want the infinite alleles model, which is a lovely sort of classical model, every color is new, and you can get to it here from this model here. So it is reversible. It is actually reversible. And the P, you get to it here you want D to tend to infinity here, and you want epsilon J to tend to zero here always. And here, the epsilon J is theta on k here, and you're going to fix, so you're fixing theta on d. So if you're fixing you're fixing theta and you're letting d tend to infinity, and then the limit model of that is going to be the infinite alleles model. And yeah, there's a sort of thing called the Poisson Dirichlet distribution. That's a limit distribution of the stationary distribution.
But it's not stationary anymore in the strict sense, right?
Yeah.
You let e to infinity.
Yeah, stationary.
But
yeah.
There's no state space.
Well, you have to make the model. You have to set up the model more correctly, but it's correct. Yeah. You can set up the model more formally. There's a measure value diffusion with an infinite state space. And then in the Poisson Dirichlet just random measure. You have to have a random measure. And so you have to give these i's a sort of distribution as well. And you have a measure value diffusion with a Poisson Dirichlet is the stationary distribution of measure value diffusion. But I don't think you want to know about that. That's not a long time talking about. So I hope that's some sort of idea of that. It's any more sort of important idea about those things. And this is the sampling distribution. I wanted to sort of describe here how you might get this equation here for the probability distribution of n. So this gives you a way to do some sort of computations, because you can find ways in which to solve it. Now, we want to actually know p of n here, because as a sort of... if you're a theoretical geneticist, you do, applied geneticist, you want to know P of N. It's telling you the likelihood of the sample. You want to know what's the probability of the sample you've got. And you might want to vary the parameters, say theta in this case, or the PIJs, and see what the likelihood gave you and told you. We might want to do that for more complicated models as well, but for a start, we want to think about the sort of simplest model we could do probably. So how do we actually derive this? The way you derive this, and it's a sort of usual way of looking back in time here, you can derive it from either a coalescence perspective or from a diffusion generator perspective. So I thought I'd sort of explain how you might do this in the two different cases here. This is the one with the light, I think. So you think about this coalescent process here, and it starts off here with n individuals, n lines going back in time here, and you say, what's going to come first? Are we going to have a coalescence, or are we going to have a mutation back in time coming first? And what's the probability of both happening? So the probability here, if you look at the rates are actually n choose 2 here for coalescence, and the total mutation rate, remember it's theta on 2 along the lineages, it's a Poisson process. So if you like, there are sort of competing exponentials here telling you which is going to occur first. This is the coalescence rate. This is the total mutation rate, because you've got n lineages here and the rate's theta on 2 of a cross coming on one of the lineages. And so if you want the probability of mutation first, what would that be? That would be just theta on 2n, divided by n choose 2. And that simplifies here to theta on theta plus n minus 1. You're right. Thanks. It's a total rate, yeah. So the competing exponentials, and this is the probability here that this one occurs first in that. And so there's an n, a factor of n and 2 that cancels out here. So that's the probability here that we will have a mutation first. And so what you do is you just argue, really, conditional on which one occurs first. So looking at the equations here, what have we got here? This is the probability here that we had a mutation first. What's the probability that we've got a configuration of n? Well, it's the probability that we had a mutation first back in time. Then the configuration might have been that we had an extra type I back in time, and then we mutated from I to J. So the E's are just unit vectors here, and the bold N is the configuration of types. So in that case here, we'd lose the type J, we'd gain the type J coming forward, and we'd lose the type I. It's just a sort of law of total probability here. It's a Chapman-Kolmogorov equation, actually, in the coalescent tree. Is everybody okay with this? And here we would have chosen here, we've got since we've got an extra I here, the probability that we choose that one to be the mutant is ni plus 1 on n. We're given that one's mutated, so this is the probability that we really do have that happening. Or if I is j, we have to mess with this one here. Is that all right? See, this is what summing over all prior configurations, when you knew there was a mutation. And this one here is when you had a coalescence. So this is probably the first event back in time was a coalescence. Then if it was a coalescence, the configuration beforehand would have been one less of that type if the jth one coalesced. And to actually, so for coalescence sort of backward in time is like reproduction forward in time, it's like branching forward. And so the chance that you actually choose it to branch is when you've got a configuration like this, is nj minus 1 on n minus 1. You know you've chosen one to branch, so that this is the probability you've chosen this type j1 to actually branch. So that's how you get it as a coalition tree argument. How do you actually get it from a diffusion generator argument? Well, you can get it from the diffusion generator argument just by doing the following thing. If you've got this is in a stationary distribution. So we're using here the fact that, in fact, this P here is the same. This P, the probability of this is the same as this P function here. And that's using a sort of consistency condition in the coalescent process, that if we took a slice across the coalescent tree and asked for the probability distribution of the configuration of types, that would be the same as if we really started off with those individual. So if you've got a sort of n tree and you take the slice when you've got k things, then the sort of distribution of types in those k is the same as if you started off with the k. That's a consistency of these trees. So this p is the same as this p here. And you can get it from the diffusion generator by saying, you know that in the stationary distribution of the diffusion, if you take the expected value of L times any function of x is equal to zero, where x is the set of the frequencies, probability frequencies. That's true for any generator, that this is a backward generator, and that's what happens in the stationary distribution of the process. That defines the stationary distribution. Expectation is in that. So in this case here, EF of x that you're using would be this function here. So you put in f of x is equal to just this quantity. Factorial n on n1 up to nd factorial times this product here. I, this is your f of x in this equation. And so just using this generator here, you can see what happens with the, if we went back to the generator, what we'd have is terms here in the generator where if you're differentiating here, you differentiate and you've got an extra xi coming in here. And so that gives you, you can believe that gives you the sort of mutation term if you work through that. And the second order one here gives you the coalescence terms involved in that. It's surprising actually how nicely it comes out, because you might think that this kind of term here is much more complicated. But that kind of term here, simply when you look at a coalescent framework, just gives you this term here, actually. So things cancel out. There's no losing two bits and so on. It all works out nicely, and the diffusion generator gives you that. So that's a very sort of automated way of getting that equation in a sort of technical way, rather than using a probabilistic argument. Neither argument is better. They're just different ways of getting it. So I want to come on to how you might actually calculate P of n at this stage from a sort of coalescent history here. So this is a coalescent history idea here. And I want to talk about important sampling and coalescent histories too, to be able to evaluate this likelihood or the probability of your sample. So these objects in the sample could be DNA sequences, of course, with a fixed number of bases and the way it works, or they could be other kinds of things. So the idea of a coalescent history here is to think of the embedded Markov chain here, where you start off with zero here and you go sort of back in time here. This sort of description is sort of fairly formalized from Matthew Stevens and Peter Donnelly. It's a nice description. And we're going to sort of go back in time here going to use negative indices going back in time. So you decrease to minus m here, where minus m is where you get the ancestor state here. And you're looking at the embedded chain, embedded Markov chain here, where you actually change types here. So here's a type here here's where you've had a mutation here. So this is supposed to be where, sort of going back in time, you gained an I here, but you lost a J. So this, you mutated in this direction, but going back in time, you gained this I and you lost the J. So we want to go back in time. So the problem is for this coalescent tree material, you might think you know the forward transition probabilities of types, but you don't. You only actually know the backward ones. You know the forward transition probabilities of types in this Markov chain on the coalescent tree from the root to the leaves, but you do not know the backward ones. You don't know how to do it backward. And so if we really would like to run backward in time with these mutations, and we don't have a way of reversing it. It's not an easy problem. We don't have a stationary distribution. We don't know how to reverse it. We have to think of some way to do this. So that's the objective in this sort of important sampling context here. We're starting off at H0 now and going back in time here with this sort of idea. And here's where a coalescence has occurred. Minus M here can be the common ancestor there. This is really just sort of saying formally what I said. It's a set of configurations here at the embedded events in the Markov process where coalescence, mutation or other events take place. And this is the current time, this is the state when singleton ancestors reached, and the configurations here have distribution P of N here. That's the probability here, you have this configuration of N at any slice in the tree. That's the consistency condition in these trees. I want to talk now about a way to do this, which has had some success and some failures. It's not easy to do, but it's a good technique to do it. There's quite a lot of work starting off with Simon Tavare. I mean, we didn't call it sequential important sampling at all when we started, but it became known as that. And Matthew Stevens and Peter Donnelly did a lot of work on it. And this is a nice paper sort of describing the ways that you might do it. So it's got quite a history, this way of doing things. And that's quite nice as a sort of probabilistic setting. So suppose we have these history states. We could actually write down this equation here. This is the equation that I wrote down before. That's exactly what one was doing here. You're summing over all the prior configurations. So you're summing here over the dash configurations, which give you your configuration. That's just a Chapman-Kolmogorov equation in this Markov chain. Summing over all the prior configurations, and this is the probability you got your configuration given the previous history state. Now that's the equation we derived in that probabilistic way. So these forward ones are actually known, but the probability of these states are not known. We'd like to know these. We want to know P of H0, in fact, or P of Hj, really. But we don't know any of these things. We know the forward ones. We'd like to know something about the backward ones, but we don't know. We'd like to run this process back. This is running a process. This is a forward equation from the root down. And the way this works is the following. Now, this is a fairly important slide, so don't sort of gloss over on it. The idea here is we want to somehow run this chain backward in time here. So this would be transition probabilities in a reverse chain, going from really the state backwards here. And we don't know how to do this. We know Hj. We know Hj given the one, we know this one. Given this one where my top hand is, but we'd like to go back and say, what was that state given the state here? We want to go that way. And so this is saying, what was it really back in time, given the current configuration? You see that these have been interchanged from the forward one. And so one way to do it is sort of to reinterpret this forward equation as a backward equation here. It's quite a clever construction, in fact. And it comes under sequential import and sampling. For those that might know something about particle filtering, it's something like particle filtering, but there's no resampling in it. But it belongs to that class of processes.
Where every particle corresponds to one possible trajectory?
Yes. You could have several going once, but usually you don't do resampling in these. Like you could. So, and it's back in time here, but it still falls into that general class of things. And so the way I describe it, my take's a little bit different from some other authors' take. It's a bit different from the way that Stevens and Donnelly would describe it and other people. So a common sort of way to describe it is to say, oh, you don't know what the genealogy is. It's an unknown sort of parameter in it, and you're going to use sequential importance sampling to try and get over the fact that you don't know what the unknown genealogy is. That's not quite the way I see it. I see it very much in this reversibility sort of question, that you don't know how to go back. That's my take on it, which is slightly different from other authors' take. So be aware of that if you read the other comments. It'll look different in other people's presentations. So my way of thinking about it is you're renormalizing this here, and you've just actually stuffed this in. So we don't know these at all. We're going to put in here something we've guessed up. We've dreamed up something that we hope looks like the proper process going back in time. And this is a big issue as to how to choose this. How are we going to choose things to go back in time like this? Well, if we do this here, we're rescaling this equation. So if we got rid of that, we just got the forward equation. But we're going to sort of stuff it in here, and we've still got the right equation here. Then if we iterate this equation, and we thought of it as sort of going back here, and we iterate it with respect to this quantity here, we move from that to that, and we're thinking about we're moving here now, not in the real process, but backward in time in this dreamed up reverse process. See the idea? We're going to go backward here in this reverse process now that we've dreamed up. And if we just sort of iterate this here, then we keep getting these ratios here. And the expectation here is under p hat now. So that doesn't appear because that's the probability of the sample path going back. And we end up with the ancestor here. And these guys here just give us a sample path that we've actually observed back in time. We're just doing it this way.
So you're not adapting it to p-hat. So p-hat is somehow chosen.
It's chosen beforehand, yes. Yes, it could be adaptive, but it's not. Yeah. Yes. There are a lot of possible improvements to this adaption or anything like that. So this p-hat is just sort of chosen, and we're not trying to change it. We've decided some sort of way to do this. And we've got these ratios now like this. And then if you look at it here, this is the probability of a history path here going really from minus m to minus m plus 1 down to naught. That's just a sort of conditional probability chain going from minus m to 0 here. And so I've written it here as remembering it starts at minus m, the probability of a history going in that direction. The other one here is like the probability of coming from the other direction, except it's missing a p of H0. So we're going from H0 now to the ancestor. I've divided by that because we're sort of missing a term here. So that's an important kind of idea. Why is it important? Because it gives you a way to actually calculate p of H0, which is like the probability of the configuration. Because if you simulate this, if you simulate this process millions and millions of times, it literally is millions of times usually, then each time you simulate, you get a history path going back. This is under p hat. So you've got a history path going back, and with this history path going back, you know all the things here. So you know this, you know this, and you know P of H minus M in this as well. So you'd simulate, okay. So we simulate one path back, and we've got some sort of probability going back, naught to minus M. We know how to calculate this. We know these forward things. We know these because we're using these, so we know them. And that gives you one sort of empirical value of this importance weight. This is the importance weight. And you do it again. We do it again. And we do it 10 million times. 1 million might be enough. And we take the average here of it. And then this gives us the probability of H0 in theory. Yeah.
If you're going to simulate something a million times, wouldn't it be easy to simulate the forward process?
That's a good point. You could simulate the forward process, but in these big state spaces, you never hit your you never hit your configuration. So you want the probability of a given configuration H0, not just one that's happened. You see your data. So H0 is your data. You're a biologist and you've got this particular configuration. And you want to know the probability of that. You don't want to know, sort of, if I simulate, what sort of distribution would I get? Yeah, that's the difference in that question. You never hit your, if you get a big state space, you never hit yours. Yeah. So this is a big state space construction. Yeah.
Why do you call this sequential importance and not just importance?
You could call
them.
Yeah, it's sequential because it's a stepwise kind of proposal.
But it's an important sampling.
It's an important sampling on the whole history, yeah. But it's Markov. That's why it's sequential. It's just a come up to be known as that. It is regular important sampling. It's important sampling on the process, yes. But it's become known as sequential important sampling. June Lewis done a lot. He's got a book of sequential important sampling in, I think it's Scientific Problems or Evaluative Problems or something. But June Lewis has done a lot, and he's got a nice book on that if you get interested in that idea. So another point here is that what's the actual optimal proposal distribution? How should I choose P hat? That's the big problem here. What do I do to choose P hat? Well, in this case here, you can see the optimal choice of P hat is the real reverse run. If you had the real reverse ones, if these were really true, so if the P hats really described the real process back, then these two would cancel out and you get P of H naught exactly. The importance weight would be 1. And so you would get exactly P of H 0. But the problem is you don't know what these are. So this gives a sort of way of doing it that's become important. No, I shouldn't use the word important two ways. Okay, so how do you do it? There's some ways of sort of doing this, and so this is a bit of a description of how you might sort of do that. Suppose you let BJ be the event that a type of gene J is the first type that's involved in a coalition of mutation event back in time, in a sample of N genes, when you've got a type configuration of N, yeah. So this is like the bold N here that we had before. You might sort of use a sample approximation and take maybe P hat of BJ given N, some approximation, B and J and N. That's a sort of no knowledge kind of approximation, in fact. If you knew your sample was just that configuration, you might say, oh, well, the next gene back in time has to be involved in coalescence or mutation. So how should I sort of choose that? Well, that would be a sort of no-knowledge kind of choice here, in effect, because this would be true as a heuristic argument in the entire population. If you had the whole lot laid out, then the probability it would be involved in the event would be just PJ, if it has a stationary distribution PJ, because that would be the sort of relative frequency of types all the time. So it mightn't be such a bad sort of approximation to do this kind of trick here. And in fact, some work with Maria De Oria and myself shows that it's quite good. There's actually an equivalent diffusion process generator approximation here that gets that. So you know that this is true here in the stationary distribution of the process here, because this is true for any stationary distribution here. The expected value of the generator times any function is always zero. And this is actually an approximation which leads to this. If you actually assume that, this is a bit like a balance condition. If you assume that for each component here, you actually had the expected value to be zero for each J, and you did assume some sort of exchangeability, which is not really there, you end up with a system of equations that you can solve, which is equivalent to that other condition, in fact. So you've got this in general, but you don't in general have that equation. You don't have it component-wise for each of the terms in the generator. But actually, this assumption here is equivalent to this other assumption I had back in the other slide. So you can do it in this sort of mechanized way by looking at these equations here and assuming some exchangeability and then trying to solve them. Really, in a sense, you have these sort of sets of equations here, but if you sort of assume some exchangeability, you can sort of patch together a proposal distribution for going back in time.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Can you state this as an optimization problem?
Maybe, I don't know. In what way?
Well, optimization of this. Well, some functional which you want to minimize.
I don't think so, but I'm open to any suggestions. This is, in a sense, a technical trick, trying to see how could you... It's a sort of a first-order approximation to the stationary distribution, I think. I mean, you've got... This is a real equation. And this is a sort of... it's a sort of a first-order approximation that each expectation in each one of these should be zero. I'd like to know if the physicists have a better idea of a better way of doing it. So, not so comfortable with it, but it's a good technique. But there might be better ways to actually do that. So you need a sort of approximate solution to P of n, which we haven't got.
I have another question about this important stuff.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to apologize because I'm going to use just statistical physics jargon in the whole question.
Okay.
Yeah. It seems what you're trying to compute is something like a partition function with some specified boundary conditions.
It is a partition function,
yeah.
Yes.
And usually when one does that with numerical Monte Carlo, rather than making up a distribution you're going to sample from, usually what you do is you integrate a free energy down in temperature from infinite temperature to your final temperature. But what that means is that you have some parameter, which in the physics case...
Yes, like beta or something, temperature, yeah.
Such that at 1/9 parameter, you know the distribution exactly.
Yeah.
And then integrating it, you're sort of, as you step this parameter along, you're using the important sampling of 1 as your p hat to get your next p.
Yeah.
And the ratio of these two is what we call the free energy.
Yeah.
And so you're just integrating that along.
Yeah.
And this is the usual way of doing it. I'm wondering if a similar approach has been tried here, perhaps, you know, the analog of high temperature with the agitation.
No, I don't think so. I don't think you could do this. You could cool it. You could have a simulated annealing kind of approach where you took one. So these approaches here have a benefit. In fact, each time you do the simulation, you just sort of you simulate, then you do another one. You do another one. But you could think that the p hat learns.
So, the idea is not to learn the p hat.
No, but
it's to do the sampling for a different sequence of Markov models, and then.
Yeah, but the different sequence of Markov models has to be the different p hats, and you could do the annealing by trying to improve the p hat and have some temperature thing where the p hat sort of improved, I think, as you went along. But I don't think it's so appropriate to have it within the sampling. No.
So the whole notion is that the p hat. For one temperature is the P from a different temperature.
Yeah, there's no difference in temperatures. But you could actually have some sort of simulated annealing thing where you thought you were doing better as you went along with some sort of parameter. You'd have to actually describe how the parameter worked in these P hats, in a sense.
But let me talk later because I'm not describing simulated annealing, I'm describing something else.
Okay.
You're describing cooling. But without proposal, right? So it's not a sort of proposal. You're describing how to you suggest some other way of picking this big head, and what is described here is not the same.
Right, so I'm asking, has anyone done it? Or is there a reason to try it this way? Because that is the standard way to compute a partition function in step fit.
You're thinking of it within the actual, yeah, within the actual diffusion equation,
yeah,
rather than across the p-hats.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I don't know of anything. I mean, people have tried sort of, but it wouldn't surprise me. But, I mean, you can try this sort of same trick with MC-MC kind of things. I quite like the important family. I like the independence of the runs and various things like this. And I mean, so if you choose the wrong p-hat, you're in trouble, because if you choose the wrong p-hat, you go into parts of the space with high probability that you don't want to be in, and the importance weights are low, and so typically you get a pile of low weights, you might get a good one, a pile of low weights, a good one. That's not what you want. You'd like to actually have the weights around about one, as close as you can get, and not too much variation. But if you've got a mass, see, this is in the simplest case, but you can go into very bigger problems where you get into trouble with big state spaces. It's not a sort of idea that will solve everything, but it's quite a, if you get a good p hat, you're doing well, basically. So it's a question of getting a good p hat, so anything that sort of gives a good way of doing it would be good. Appreciate it. Yep.
Isn't the only approach for calculating
the p-hats? No, you could use MC-MC kind of technique.
And try to kind of one answer as a proposal for another for this.
Type. Yes. You have to have sort of gross kind of changes in the coalescent process. So you choose one history, and then you move from one history to another history. It's a sort of Markov process way of doing it. That might be something I can do, but you can do a sort of MC-MC thing where you've got transitions between histories. But the transitions between histories are quite gross. This is what always worries me, and maybe it shouldn't, because I know that you have to actually get to all the states. But you do things like sort of picking a big chunk of the process and regrafting it somewhere else. Or you do gross changes, basically, to the tree, which are non-coalescent. They're quite changes that are not like coalescent moves at all. You're just simply trying to get to a different state and explore different possible states of the process. But that's one thing that sort of slightly worries me, but I'm not sure whether it should in MC-MC. This has got a nice lot of theory about it. And so this idea, the one I'm going to describe here, comes from Stevens and Nonley, really. Well, Bayes' rule, of course, you could try and do this. When you suggest this problem to people, they often think, oh, he's being silly. It's really an easy problem to reverse the process. But it's not, believe me, because you don't know the stationary distribution. And it's not a simple problem. But you might think it's simple. It's not. So Bayes' rule here is, of course, expressing the rates in a different direction here, and you don't know what these are here, but you do know the forward way of going here. So you know this here. You don't know those, and you don't know those here. But you might sort of approach this by saying, define pi of I given n as the probability that an additional type chosen from the population is of type I, given a sample configuration of n, then the reverse chain transition probabilities could be expressed in this way here. You can sort of, this equation here really is, it's not so much that. It's really just a sort of exchangeability kind of condition here. This is from the way it comes from the diffusion. You could pick a configuration of n minus ej and then pick this type j here. So this is a probability here that you get a type j given you have a sample of that weight, and it doesn't depend on which j you pick. That's the exchangeability of the sampling that you have. It doesn't matter which order in which you sample them. You can see that from a multinomial description of it if you want. But don't be worried by this coefficient here. It's easy, in fact. remember, it's an expectation of a multinomial thing, and you know, maybe you'd like me to see, you'd like to see how that comes about, possibly. It's really a sort of easy equation. So what we've got is you're thinking about the expected value of that term there, and you want really so pi of sort of j comma the joint probability that the next one was that, and that the sample was n minus ej here would be the expected value of a sort of multinomial kind of term here, factorial n1, etc. But you'd have nj minus 1, the combinatorial term would be different, up to nd factorial. But you'd still have all the product of I belong to E, x, I, v, and I. You'd still have all that term there, in fact. And so the combinatorial terms, this is n minus 1 actually. In fact, because you only have the combinatorial term for this one here. And so that's sort of where your factor of n on nj comes there. It's not a deep kind of formula, in fact. It's just a conditional probability formula here. In that. Oh. Where are we? Yeah. So it's a ratio of these p's. So if you know the p hats, you know the pi's. Or if you know the pi's, you know the p's. That's the point of it. And so you can express these proposals here like this. Instead of having p hats, you can have pi hats here. And so that's a sort of nice way to express it here. This is from Stevenson Donnelly's sort of way of thinking about it. So these pi hats are what's sort of important. In fact, the fine details here probably are hard to absorb if I just sort of put them up on the screen here. But these are the sort of proposals here that you get, and there's the importance weights. But it's hard to see just sort of looking at them. But they're the terms that come from that recursion that we saw. And did you want a certain detail? This one here, what's got to happen is the proposal times the weight is the coefficient in this recursion here. That's important. That's the sort of thing. And so Stevens and Donnelly give this sort of approximation here for these. Yeah.
Very naively, I start thinking about running the coalescent backwards and taking two types,
right,
and merging them, right? Two types which are closer on the hypercube, right, which takes a few mutations, are more likely to merge in a short time. So that would be, it's a very, very intuitive notion, right?
You're thinking of a whole sequence?
Yeah.
So that should be new.
I'm sort of looking at these little expressions here, and I haven't seen anything even vaguely reminiscent of that emerging.
Well, it depends on the PIJs, you see. So if you had sequences here, so you in a sequence sort of setting, the PIJs, you might only have a model where you can change by one base at a time. So if you did that, you can only really sort of come from a sort of hypercube type of mutation where you move along the vertices of the hypercube with mutation.
But I guess that's where...
It's this PIJ thing.
I thought we wanted to... It's the first process.
Fine. They have to be identical to coalesce. You can only coalesce them when they're identical, because it's nj, nj minus one. You can only coalesce identical ones.
I understand.
Yeah. It's a tight sort of, it is a tight sort of.
What you're telling me is what I'm describing here has to emerge from composition of many such little steps.
Well, you can only make transitions that are sensible. You don't make sort of stupid transitions. You can only sort of coalesce within the groups, within the types. And similarly with mutation here, you can only do sensible things. I mean, say you had a model, just for definiteness, of a sequence, and you decided that forward in time, you could only mutate at one base, which is the usual model. Well, in that case, you're sort of thinking mutation along sort of edges of a hypercube.
Yeah, but I don't know how the beauty of coalescent was that it was already sort of a Gillespie-type event-driven representation of the process. So compared to sort of the full diffusion thing that we're staring at over there, right? So at some point, right, you described sort of the sampling as we're going to throw on the board all possible coalescence.
No, not all possible.
And then assign a probability distribution to them according to likelihood of diffusion. I'm sorry, mutation events on appropriate branches, right?
Yeah.
I can compute the whole probability that way, right? So I can think of a Monte Carlo as some sampling of this process, right? I throw out, I generate the coalescent.
You can't compute.
And assign probability to it.
That's the probabilistic description forward in time, yeah. But you can't compute.
Backward in time, because
you can't do it back.
Coalescent.
Pardon?
I'm generating a coalescent.
That's right.
And I'm assigning a probability to it based on mutation probability.
There's no, you can't write down the backward transition probabilities, that's the point. So you have to actually use some other way to be able to run backward in time. You just can't do it. There's no way to do that.
Okay, maybe we'll pick it up after.
Yeah.
Is it sort of that it's conditional on the states of the tips?
Yes. Yes.
The backward,
yes.
That if you wanted to generate a random set of tips under the model,
if you got a random set of tips.
I'm wondering if that's.
Yeah, partly the question.
No, I'm not even describing it as a Markov process right now, right? We're just generating trees, right? Generating coalescence. That's not very difficult. Well, there are lots of them, right? But we can sample that space, and we can assign a probability.
You can generate things forward, but it's a big state space, and so you can't really work out probabilities of types very easily that in complicated models, because you never hit your kind of thing. In simple cases, but not in general.
Is the point is just saying that in certain limits, the transitions backward in time are dominated by certain paths, even if you can't actually work out the
track. Well, they will be dominated by certain ones, but this should, you have this sort of picks them up. Not quite sure what you're saying. I think it's probably some confusion about the backwards and forwards things, that you don't know them. But yeah, so these are, using a sort of technical way, these are ways in which you do that. And these are sort of, it's a type, so it's certainly a type configuration going back. I mean, as Dick said, you're going back and you're working out what's happening here. And, okay. What happened? So this is a Stevens Nolle approximation here that you choose a type from the population here, from the N, and then you just mutate this geometric number of times here to get the pi hat. So this is there from a sort of probabilistic idea how you might do that. and Maria and I were sort of working on a very sort of general way of doing it. And so this general way of doing it from this diffusion generator agrees with the Stevens and Domes. It's exact. It gives their construction here in general. So it gives this as well, if you use that diffusion generator approximation, which is nice. But we, in a sense, the Stevens and Donnelly construction doesn't give you a way to do it in more complicated processes. It only tells you in their specific cases that they've done how to do it. It doesn't give you a general principle to do it. And so this diffusion generator approximation does give you a general way to do it and seems to work well.
I according to the frequency, and then I make M iterations.
Right. That's it. Yeah. This is not PIJ to the power L. It's the it's in the Elf matrix.
That is the F power of the mutation.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. You're just going through sort of L. So it's like choosing a sort of edge and saying you had that many mutations. That's an approximation. Yeah. So that's the sort of, that was a critical thing.
And the quintessence is
You don't have to do that because the proposals are all described in terms of the pi hat j's given ends. So you just actually use this equation here for the proposals. So proposal means just reverse transition probability. And these are your weights. So you just keep multiplying the weights together as you go back in time. So there's another sort of way of thinking about it here with this idea, saying that this was the idea to get it. You can get it from a coalescent sort of way of doing it here. So if this is the event here that are genes of type J, was the one involved in the event going back here, and Y was a vector describing the configuration of types, then you would have this exact equation here. This is a precise equation and not an approximation here. So it's a modification of that other argument that we had, but you have to have this gene of type J being involved in the event going back. So it's a more sort of detailed argument than that other argument we're using, with this type J being the one that was involved in the event going back. That's a sort of real equation that one has here. And the approximation was that maybe this is N, J and N. As I said, I'd like to hear if anybody's got better kind of, a better handle on that formula. I'd like to know. that's a sort of first order approximation, but you might want a sort of second order higher. That's not bad, actually. So this is an equation that generates a sort of set of approximate p hats, and then a set of pi hats from that equation here. And so you've got this equation here, and if you just sort of substitute in those equations, you get a linear equation for the pi hats, which you solve, and you get this same Stevens and Donnelly kind of approximate formula there. So it's nice to have that standard way of sort of being able to approach that. Just some examples here. In this particular parent-independent mutation model, which was this one I was describing here, we know the answer here, and then pi j of given n is actually pi hat of j given n, which is this. Another one, which is the stepwise mutation model, has a mutation matrix where this is a half if I minus J is 1, and it's equal to this probability here. So this is a model here where the state space is actually infinite here, and there's lots of real microsatellite data that follows approximately, possibly this model. It's not a bad first model for microsatellite data. And there's lots of these sort of data around, and they're like sort of repeats. So you might have ATG or something. I'm not sure it's a good one. ATG. And you're thinking that what happens here is that you lose one of these units or you gain one of these units by mutation. And technically here, I've made it go from minus infinity to infinity. But of course, you never really hit the negative side in a finite time. But it's not a bad model. And if you let it here have a state space on the positions from minus infinity to infinity, then this would be the proposal distribution. This would be a pi out of j given n work through there, which is rather nice. In fact, it's a bit of Fourier analysis to actually get this kind of function here. You might recognize it possibly coming from Fourier analysis.
Could you say a wee bit more about what kind of data would go into? So microsatellites is one, but this stepwise thing.
Yes.
And what other types of data might?
Oh, in the general case here, I'm thinking perhaps even sequence data, where you've got sequences or four base types or something like that. It would work very well for just four base types. I think it's kind of.
But you'd have a linked sequence with many.
You could have a linked sequence of things. Yes. So this is extended, there's a sort of extension of this to gene trees, a bit like Dick was referring to, that I won't have time in this talk, but I was going to talk about, say, next talk, applications of it. So yeah, it certainly works for, so it works very well for things without, when you get into recombination, that's another matter, that's not going to work very well. No, we tried it, but it's hard. So this is just a more complicated model that you might like here. So they were very simple models I was describing, but you can make it more complicated. And for example, here's a model here with migration here, where this is a more complicated model where you've got subpopulations, 1 to G, and you get relative subpopulation sizes, types of genes, and mutation rate, mutation matrix. So this is a new bit here. Subpopulations, and it's useful here to sort of think that you've got backward migration rates here. So M alpha beta is sort of like the probability that a lineage, this is the rate of a lineage change from subpopulation alpha to subpopulation beta back in time, like that. So in a sense, this introduces some geometry on the edges, in some sense. You get have more sort of complicated geometry. This is some sort of geometry. Where X alpha J is the relative frequency of gene type J in subpopulation alpha. So in this sort of setup here, you can only coalesce within your own subpopulation. You can't coalesce across it. I think maybe this is the sort of geometry you're thinking about, or some sort of thing like this. I'm not sure whether it's in the mutation or the coalescence, but here, you're going to scale these x's here to add to one within each subpopulation. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yep.
These Beckmar migration rates.
Yep. Up. Yep. Okay.
So they, if I follow a lineage backward in time, and if all QA's alphas are the same, all separated populations have the same size.
Yeah.
Then forward and backward migration rates are just the same, obviously.
If the m's are reversible, it is. Yeah. Yeah. So if the m's are actually reversible with respect to this measure, it's forward and backward the same.
Okay. Yeah.
Otherwise, it's scaled with the rates, the relative sizes of the populations.
And these vectors of Q alpha and Q beta.
Yeah.
They intuitively tend to bring lineages to the big population.
Yes, yes. It's like a sort of semi-reversible thing. If you put the Q beta on that side, it's like one's a sort of reverse of the other. If the M was truly reversible with respect to the population sizes, you'd have one's a reverse distribution. Yeah. Because you'd take this over and you'd have M, it'd be a balance condition. It's a balance condition. Your total size remains the same, so it's number in, it's proportion out. That's where this comes from. It's a balance condition.
Q's don't change.
Q's don't change. No, no. Well, I could, but no.
Total population is fixed population size.
Yeah, even on each island, yeah.
In each one or
On each island. Everything's fixed.
So the subpopulation might not go extinct?
No, no extinction, no. No. It is it's a very simple model. It's one that's been around in the classic sort of population genetics for a long time. It's an island model in population genetics. So it's it can get a diffusion process here, and it's a bit more complicated because you've got X alpha J and X alpha. You've got it indexed by the subpopulation and the type frequency in that. So you get a more general kind of generator here. I'll put these notes somewhere if I can find where to put them so people can access them if you want. So you can write down a sort of equation in the explicit form for it. Maybe it's hard to sort of see plonking it up in front of you here, but it has the terms, so you could migrate in a sort of infinitesimal time. You can migrate, you can have one migration, or you can have a mutation here. And the coalescence terms, of course, are in the covariance terms here. There's no actual, strangely, there's no covariance here between frequencies in different subpopulations. There's only sort of covariances within subpopulations.
But this is because you impose
It's a fixed population size that's imposed. That's the reason. But when you first see that, you do wonder whether it's correct. But it's right. Yeah. So it's a sort of moderately complicated thing here, and you do scale here by the subpopulation size.
But there's no other way the whole population, the sum of all of them, to be fixed, like you left, for example.
Yeah.
Population go up or down.
It'd be a more complicated model. Yeah. And you could have extinctions in that. That might be. It's not clear whether you ever have extinctions in that model, or whether there's if migration's always recurrent. You probably have always guy going in.
Well, I think it depends on just what the migration rates is. Yes. You can have very different regimes.
Yeah, you get different regimes.
But if migration rates are high, then you'll never get an extinction. But if they are low, then genetic growth will.
If you're scaling in this direction, I don't think you'd ever. I expect that you'd always have guys coming in, and that if M is recurrent. But it's not a model I've looked at. But I think you'd always have guys there. Because of the recurrence and the way the diffusion process works. You have them sort of temporary, sort of extinct, but not. If you wrote them the generator, you'd have all the terms, but always, I think, it's just some stationary case. Okay, so that was the case. And so, well, for what it's worth, you can go through the same thing, and you've got. You've got a proposal distribution here, and again, this is a bit detailed here, but you've got coalescence within the subpopulations here of this type. You've got mutation terms, and you've got this additional term here, the migration, which is something like the mutation term, except the first coordinate has changed, and this is in the other direction because this is backward migration here rather than forward migration. But this is very, very similar to this case here. It's just that one of the coordinates is changing. And you can sort of go through and do something with this. It's a nice kind of construction. So the way that you might remember that Stevens and Donnelly construction that was around for the single population, and you can do a sort of construction here which is similar, but it's a bit more complicated. And so how would you do a pi hat of J given alpha n? Well, this is the way it comes out. If you actually scale this here to be a transition probability matrix constructed from the migration rate rate matrix M here. So M of alpha is just the row sum. So you make this to be a proper sort of transition matrix, just scaling it like that. And you have these sort of constants here. So this would be the relative probability here of migration here, I guess, compared to coalescence, probably. Yeah. Migration compared to coalescence, because, well, it's something like that. And this is a mutation compared to the three events of coalescence, migration, or mutation. So, yeah, it's a sensible kind of parameterization of it. And suppose you have a sort of transition matrix which is like this. So this is like something similar to the Stevens and Donnelly kind of transition matrix here. Because if you had one subpopulation, you'd have no sort of migration here, and this would be one. And this would be exactly the Stevens and Donnelly kind of transition matrix with a geometric number of transitions. That's the same thing in their kind of case. You have to choose the individual first, then you do this geometric number of transitions. And so this is the geometric number of transitions. But here it depends in which subpopulation that you're in.
What's rho alpha?
Rho alpha is this quantity here. Yeah. So if you had nothing here, it would be theta on n plus theta, which is like the parameter in the Stevens and Donnelly one. And q would be 1 for one subpopulation. So this is a sort of somewhat generalization to the subpopulation. And the way it works here is you do this. How do you actually choose a gene of type J here? Well, you do this subpopulation work walk first, and you choose a sequence of subpopulations starting with alpha here, starting with this alpha, and stopping at step tor and subpopulation alpha tor, like this, with this kind of probability here. So you walk, you walk, you walk, you walk, and you stop in subpopulation tor, and you have to write down the probabilities that you actually do this walk in this particular configuration here. See? This is just sort of that you don't stop. So in a sense, 1 minus 5 tor is a sort of stopping rule here. So you walk, you walk, you walk, you walk, you stop. And this is probably that specific set of transitions from alpha naught to alpha tor here. And so it's sort of interpretation moving from subpopulation alpha really to alpha tor, in fact. And then to get the mutation part of it right, you mutate, you choose a type at random from subpopulation alpha. So the probability of choosing that gene of type I is this one here. Then you mutate back here along the migration path. Remember, this is like the Stevens and Donnelly kind of construction here. Back along the migration path to alpha naught here. So a sample path probability mutation would start with type I and end up with type J here, is this thing here. So this is the Greek analogy here. You choose your individual in the population you stopped in now, in the one you stopped in, and you mutate here forward in time to your alpha naught. But when you go through these other subpopulations here, you have got a mutation matrix, which is this geometric number of transitions, which depends in which subpopulation you're in. And finally you get to that one here through this sort of sequence of parts here in that way. So that's how it sort of works. It's a nice sort of extension here of that one population case. Right. I guess, how are we all going? You're okay, fine. I can give you a real genetics application now that you might like, which is sort of much more lightweight than all that. Can you cope with another half hour?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So what I planned to do was talk about this microsatellite model, but then next talk I want to talk about gene trees, which I think you'll find very interesting. They're more like what Dick was talking about, where you...
You can't make the payment square.
You can't make them back.
You just have the room available until
1. You know, we actually do have a bit of a constraint because we said that we could do the propagation thing as large.
I'll just go, I think. I think I'll just go, because this is not so heavyweight in the maths. It's a bit easier, and it's quite a nice example here. So this is this microsatellite example here, where you change in plus and ones. And the state space here of this model here is, you want to know what's happening at the leaves. So you add up the charges along the leaves. So it's a nice sort of interesting model, particularly probably for a physicist, because you're adding up these plus and minus ones. It's a random walk on a tree. And you're adding up plus and minus ones along the edges here. So this guy here has a charge of -3 here. Or you're thinking, somehow you've scaled it to sort of mean something. It is a charge of -3 relative to this guy. But this guy might have quite a number of repeats of sort of AC, 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 AC. So this guy might have 500 ACs or something, and this guy here at the bottom would be 500 -3 ACs. It's all relative to an ancestor thing. So an ancestor, there is some sort of value of the variable here, which is probably positive. And then this guy down the bottom would be the ancestor value, because you've had a +1, -1, it's just the same. This is an extra 2. And mutations again occur at this rate of theta on 2. And the charge is +1, this sort of vanilla version. There's probably 0.5 and 0.5 here. And you add up the charges along the leaves here. But there is this actual extra thing that you think that you're colouring edges. So you can only actually coalesce within, well, you've got to be the same type for a start, and you've also got to be in the same subpopulation here. So the red one here means these lineages are in one subpopulation, and the blue one means that you're in another subpopulation. So in a sense, that's sort of geometry on the actual coalescent tree rather than the two with the mutations. You could have more complicated geometries. So you're only coalescing within that group here. So it's a fairly sort of complicated...
So you have a direct process which would correspond to that, right? So
it's that diffusion process that I just talked about.
You're describing direct.
This is a specific case where you've got charge state model, yeah. With a PIJ, so the PIJ here are always PII plus one or PII minus one. That's what's happening. It's a random walk kind of P. So this is an example here of what I was talking about. It's a more complicated one, and this is some real data from, I'll just very briefly say, this is a fun model here. Even if you just had one, if you actually had just one population, you didn't have migration in this, then the sort of distribution at the bottom here is a challenge to find here. You might try and do that. It looks as though it's plausible that you might be able to work out what the probabilities are at the bottom of different types if you just started at naught here as a sort of technical problem and your mutations occur, it's well defined. It's hard. A lot of people have tried this problem. It's not easy to, it's not known what the distribution is at the bottom. It's known that the sort of way that it works at the bottom here is the number of types is small. It's very actually small compared to what you might think. And if the sample size tends to infinity, the number of types here at the bottom tends to infinity very, very slowly. And the history of it, I think Kimura simulated and decided that it was so slow, he said, oh, we thought this should tend to a limit, as in tend to infinity. But I don't think a probabilist would say that. I think you would have a feeling it would tend to infinity, and it does, but very, very slowly. So Keston sorted out this, and it tends to infinity very slowly. So
it's slowly being what?
No, it's much, much worse. It's slower than any sort of log. It's very, very slow. So, yeah, you have to look at Keston's paper. It's a very, very slow, yeah.
Yeah,
here the probability of adding a repeat is the same as losing it?
Yeah.
And that's biologically true. There's no drift.
You get a more complicated model. It mightn't be true exactly. This is only a first approximation. Yeah.
The biology is a little bit more complicated.
It's more complicated.
The probability of adding is slightly higher than the probability of losing. Oh,
okay. So that's interesting. Yeah. No, there's your aim. So this is a sort of example. Chris has probably seen this. This is from this Marshfield data set, which is a lovely, beautiful data set from Noah Rosenberg of microsatellite data in humans here. And there are a whole lot of different subgroups here in this region here. And what's somewhat of interest is the Mabudi pygmies and the Biaki pygmies. Chris should be talking about this. Are very famous, well-studied groups here. And it's largely thought that the Mabudi pygmies here are the oldest, and perhaps older than the Biaki pygmies. And there's some sort of idea of what happened here with migration and so on. I'll show you a picture where everybody is here. So there's some certainly interesting ones here. We've got the French, but the Han and the Mabudi pygmies are interesting, and these other groups are interesting as well in that. And these are the sample sizes from the different regions here. And this one here we picked out dinucleotide loci. So that means that it means all the things had sort of AC, 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 or something like that, with just two repeats in each one to try and get the mutation rate the same for everyone. There's 21 loci here. And so the objective is to use that kind of importance family back in time to find the likelihood of your sample and to find the migration rates by maximum likelihood. And here you've actually got here effectively 21 independent loci. So you're doing 21 sets of importance sampling experiments here. And then you're varying the parameters as well to try and work out what the maximum likelihood estimate is. The repeatability is nice here if you assume the migration rate's the same for each locus, because you're getting a genuine sort of repeatability there of independence as well as each tree.
And mutation rate is assumed given? No.
The seed is assumed. The U here in the per year, yeah, mutation rate's assumed. No. Yeah.
And the same for everybody.
Yeah, we assume it is the same. That's why we've chosen these dinucleotide ones. Yeah, they're rough assumptions. So here's some data, for example. So this is just one locus here, and there are 72 Biaki people here, and two of them had length 16 when we scaled them. So it doesn't matter whether you scale this process up and down, the relative position of these charges is not important. So you just scale them, so you start off at zero or something. So you take your data and you just shift them along to a convenient, as far as the mass goes, shift them along to a convenient thing here. So these are sort of relative differences here. And there were two of them had length 16, one was at spot 15, two of them were at spot 14 and so on. And the mobility looked a bit different here. Here's another one here, a different locus here. This is one locus, this is another locus here. So that looks something like that. That'd be your data. That's one locus data, but then we've got 21. Well, that's one, that's another. But you've got 21 of these. And so there's sort of a lot of work here, but this is, these ones here. We estimated the theta, we estimated the total theta here, because you don't know the effective population sizes. And so you've got effective population sizes, and the Qs are the ratios of these effective population sizes. So you don't actually know theta. You know something about the rates here. We've taken the rates to do this. This is a pretty big rate for everybody. This is a pretty big mutation rate. I suppose it's per year, I think. Was it per generation? Per generation, thanks. It's a big rate. And so you do have to do the estimation to get the, even though you know this, to get the effective population size, you've got to estimate theta. And so these thetas are just sort of split here according to really the relative sizes here. You have to estimate this total theta, assuming it's the same. And you get these sort of effective population sizes here for the different groups. And we didn't do it with all the population, so it's not a proper analysis in a sense. We've just done it pairwise. So we've taken a pair and done the analysis, taken another pair and done the analysis, taken another pair and done the analysis, which is not a true kind of situation, but it's interesting to do, and it does show some interesting things. So if you do that, you get these sort of effective population sizes here, which might be regarded as fairly small, CRISPR. Do you think they're small, Chris? I don't know.
Yeah, that's 10,000 is more common.
Okay, so Chris thinks they're possibly double this. But this is they're not, I think they're not unreasonable, but this 10,000 seems awfully big. But you think that's right? Yeah.
It's commonly quoted.
Commonly quoted, okay. So maybe these are on the
individual tribes or for how it's not very different.
For individual one. Yeah.
So those variations might
be. Yeah. I didn't think these were too bad, but maybe they're on the small side. Yeah.
Yes. So why is it that when the similar population appears, it's sort of repeat every time it's a different estimate?
Because it's actually estimated pairwise. So this is just taking the two data from the two subpopulations and doing it with 21 loci, rather than doing a whole lot at once. So if it was a whole lot, you'd get different estimates. I mean, they're not wildly different. They're sort of roughly the same. So that's a sort of interesting idea to do that. And it's not clear what the effective population size really is. You've only got to change the rate a bit here. And if we change this rate here, which way would it go? If that's 2, if that's actually too big, then if you made that smaller, then the effective population size would be bigger. So maybe only a fact of thinking that that's possibly too big, probably should be smaller, and they would be bigger to make the same thing. It's just the product and that's important to fix the theta. So I'm not sort of too worried about it. Yeah.
I have a more general question. So this model assumes more like the population today is sort of in the stationary state of this.
Yeah.
Is there a way to test this given the data? Actually in
the
stationary state.
I don't know. Yeah, it's complicated. It's happening in time. It is an assumption.
You cannot do it from a snapshot.
You can't. Dynamics. Probably from a snapshot. You need. Yeah.
Why is the N for the Mbuti always bigger than the other one?
They're older. They've got more variation.
But aren't they actually a small group? Isn't that why they were picked in the first place? Because they're a small isolated group.
But they've got a lot of variation.
It's
a variation.
Isn't it because of the out of Africa thing?
Yes.
The reason that you have most variation in Africa rather than in French.
Yeah, there's more variation in those guys. So, okay, so you can do that.
So is there some other way of, did this analysis deduce the populations? Is there some way of falsifying these ends? What do we do with the
numbers? There are actually parameters in the model, in effect. And for human populations, they're not, even though they're a bit small, they're not unreasonable. You might go from sort of those kind of numbers up to about 20,000 or something.
In the sense that you did more population simultaneously, what direction these things would move?
No, I don't know. To be honest, to actually do that, it was just so much work to do. So each one of these is a massive amount of work. The estimation's quite a bit. So you get these sort of rates here per lineage going back in time of these ones here. I don't know whether that means very much per generation. And these are the backward rates here. And so the M's are the scale. These ones here are sort of backward rates per lineage, per generation, in units of 10 to the minus 3. I'm not sure whether Chris reads this better than I do.
So you're detecting variations, yes, say, between the sort of migration between, say, the Mabudi and the French.
Yes. Yes, the Mabudi and the French here.
Can I restate my question again? So the question is, how can one confirm
or deny? You can only sort of get various statistics which sort of confirm or support what you're doing.
Right, and get the same answer. So that would be one test.
But you can't actually prove it in any sense or anything like that.
Why not? But if you look at the different set of loci and get the same numbers, then you would be confident that
it's not clear.
Now, if they do not agree, you can find some way out. But the prediction is that they should agree on average if you do lots of loci. And what I'm trying to understand is whether we already see some agreement just precisely by comparing these pairwise inferences, to the extent that they're consistent.
Yeah, they're moderately consistent in what happens there. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, I was happy enough that they're sort of consistent moderately in that way. No, but I just don't know the answer how to do that. I mean, you just hope that you're finding a consistent story, whatever you do. Yeah. What distribution?
The distribution of the length.
The lengths and things. Yeah.
Just the original. Just compare the distribution. They give
them. Yeah. Yes, that'd be a thing to do. Yeah.
Infinite migration rates or something.
Yeah. But just if you look at these here, so you read these things backward here. So this is a high rate back from the Biaki to the Mabudi. High rate back from the Palestinians to the Mabudi. You read them backwards. They're backward rates. Quite a high rate from the French to the Mabudi. And the Biaki rates somewhat different.
These migration rates, again, how do I read them? So I follow the lineage in the French population backward in time, then the probability that it came from the Mbuti in the previous generation.
Yeah.
Is this number?
Yeah, these are the rates per lineage per generation back. Yeah, V1 and V2.
And units of 10 to the minus
6. Yeah, yeah. I think it has some real sort of interest. So, for example, this is what you would do with likelihood contours for migration rates for the Mabuti and the Biaki here. You would actually have to get some sort of I can't do it here for what's happening here. So you run this important sampler, and you run it for a lot of values of M1 and M2, and then you put the values. This is what's happening here. This is the Kriging surface, which is a way of fitting a multivariate kind of normal surface with a particular covariance matrix to your noisy data. So you've got noisy likelihoods here. It's very interesting. So your importance weight is your likelihood. So you get one likelihood, you get another likelihood, and so on like that. And then you average them, and that's giving you one value. Then you move your M's, and you do it again. You move your M's, and you do it again. Now, each one of these is millions of runs. And so when you do that, you've got a noisy likelihood surface, and you have to fit some smoothing over it to try and work out where you are. And that's the kind of picture you get. I wanted to finish... not quite finished, but to show in another thing that I haven't really discussed is that you can actually put time in this process as well. So with this important sampling technique back in time, you could not only have a Markov chain at the embedded events, but you can include the times as well. And so the more general sort of version of that is where you have times in between the events. And so in that case there, what you get is you're really getting a likelihood, then you get an empirical description of your process back in time, including times, for that likelihood. Then you run it again, and so you get another sort of likelihood, which is the important weight, and you get an empirical distribution. You get another sort of version of what went back on. This is all conditional upon your observed sample. So you keep doing it. So you have a whole lot of sort of likelihoods and sort of histories of what went on back in time corresponding to those likelihoods. So if you rescale them, you've got a sort of empirical distribution of histories going back in time. And so, for example, you can work out the time to the ancestor by averaging with respect to that empirical distribution of all the times you get. So looking at these ones here, if you're thinking about just how to read this thing, there's 21 loci here, so there's 21 loci in that. There's 21 of these columns here, and for each pair here, there's a pairwise analysis here. We've looked at the time to the most recent common ancestor from these processes. This is not one run. This is each one of these dots might be a million runs or something, and the dots here give you a sort of feel. So this says here, these are all these pairs here at this particular locus here, which are telling you times the ancestor. And the idea is really just to get a feel for what's happening here. And it makes some sense here. So the Mabuti are linked with the other subpopulations here, which are the open circles. And the heavier circles, it's hard, the French are hard to read here. Light grid. So the Mabuti, what have we got? Yeah, it's Mabuti. But the Biaki and the others are the heavier circles. So by and large here, the Mabuti have a larger time to the most recent common ancestor than do the Biaki. So it makes some sort of sense that what's happening there. And these time units are in units of 10 to the 4th years. And I think they're probably not unreasonable, Chris might disagree with me, but they're not terribly bad, I think.
No, it would be interesting to see a comparison for two populations outside Africa.
Yes. So there's a lot of real data out there on this, and it's very interesting stuff. It's an enormous amount of work to do this. It's quite, the coding and the running. It's quite a bit. This is where they are. This is the Mabuti and Biaki.
So do those numbers on the previous slide make sense in terms of how far away they are? So I mean, that the time is the time to the common ancestor of the two populations.
Yeah. I haven't got sure. Pick a pair. So let's pick a pair.
No, but the ancestry within one of those goes farther back than that one imagined is the time at which those populations split.
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's right.
Not a
that's a good point.
Split.
So which time is measured on this diagram?
Oh, these are the times from most recent common ancestor, but as Dick says, the split goes back, if you think of them as sort of splitting, they go back way, way past that.
The model is not a splitting model
anyway. No, it's not a splitting model anyway. So, I mean, I'm not really sort of apologising for the simplicity of the model. It's hard enough to get the results in it, you see, but they're all kind of, you know, crude results.
So the splitting is more recent than this time.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I see what you mean. They go back further than the spread. Yeah. They go back further than the spread.
I think these times are short, a little bit short, and it's consistent with your idea that mutation rate is too high.
I think that mutation rate might be a fraction too high.
A bunch of autosomal loci.
Yeah.
Think that the common ancestor will look like the same. Like this would have many examples going back 500,000.
So we figure we could rescale it all. I think the mutation rate's actually a wee bit, it was taken from that paper, you see, but we think it's actually a bit high, I suspect. And that is, so this is all mutation rate dependent. I mean, if you just vary the mutation rate a bit, it changes the ancestry and it changes all the population size and everything else, you see. So it's quite sensitive to whether that's really right. And it did look a bit big, I must say.
How did they obtain that estimate? It wasn't an empirical estimate.
No, I don't think so. No, it might be, you know, some sort of way.
It is possible to measure those things empirically.
Oh, yeah.
Like the satellites are high enough to
see
your memories.
Yeah.
It's the actual distribution.
So, yeah, we can talk more about it. So that's all I wanted to say today, but then I want to talk about sometime about gene trees, which you'll find, I think, very interesting. So Dick and I were sort of vaguely thinking we might share a session tomorrow. And
so why were those particular populations chosen? I mean, is this...
Oh, well, only because...
...of well-defined ethnic groups?
Yeah. Oh, why did Rosenberg choose them? You mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I suppose they're well-defined groups. And maybe Chris has...
It goes back to the days of the human genome diversity project that attempted to sample human worldwide diversity with the constraints that it wanted cell lines from particular from the samples that entered detection, and that limited it essentially to the samples that people happen to have in the labs. Various complex reasons, so you could see it as a fairly kind of arbitrary sampling of populations that anthropological geneticists were interested in 10 or 20 years ago. So I think there's no kind of well thought out sampling scheme behind it.
Different sort of question. Going back to important sampling and Monte Carlo and everything else, one could ask, you know, for a test of the efficiency of this parametric inference, just on some artificial data. So if you take your favorite model with a well-known, with the mutation rate of your choice, and then try to invert from a sample of a given size, and the question is how well these algorithms do.
How do they do? Yeah,
you can do it. Things depend.
Yeah, you can do it in
sample
size. So you can do it in two. Yeah, I don't know the answer. It's hard to actually do it. Simon Tavari and I did in the early days did quite a bit of that. But yeah, it works okay for things that we know and agrees. It's hard work to do that because each of these things is sort of a million runs to or more to do for a single important sampling. You've got to do a lot of runs.
So it agrees in the sense that
it's very hard to do sample
bias estimate.
There's good indications it works well.
Increases with the size of the sample in some way that you understand.
The variance doesn't decrease that much with the size of the sample because they're all connected to ancestry. So it's tempting to think that the variance decreases. But even if you had an infinite sample, it wouldn't give a variance of zero. It's random in the limit. You've got the population random distribution even in the limit. So you don't, it's not the same as resampling. It's not the same as sampling that improves with little n. It does improve, but it doesn't tend to a consistency as little n tends infinity.
So for example, we have this measurement of theta. How does one put the error bar?
Theta would be consistent with n as n tends infinity in a sort of log n type of fashion. It's not a root n kind of convergence. It's a log n. Because it's all connected through ancestry, so it's not like independent samples of things. You don't
self-averaging, right? In statistical physics language, I guess one would say it's not self-averaging.
Yeah, there might be words in physics. Yeah.
But the current size of number of loci and population that are sampled, what's the limitation on important sampling? Is it limited? Is it too slow?
It works very well for the infinitely many sites model that Dick was talking about. And I'll talk about that. That's gene trees later. If you include recombination, there's still theory work going on to try and improve it. You've got to improve the p-hats, basically, or the pi-hats. But recombination is difficult. A lot of people have tried that. I've tried that, and Fernand Donnelly tried it. It doesn't work great. So if you get into a big state space, you can get into troubles with this. Mutation seems to work fine, and migration's not bad. If you put a whole lot of subpopulations, you can get into trouble probably, but two works fine.
So there's no point in trying to improve on mutation model?
Oh, if you get a better p-hat, it could work. I mean, you just need to actually get these reverse transition probabilities correct, then it has some chance.
Right,
but that's the important thing, to get that. That's the, yeah.
I guess another shift of the same question.
Yeah.
If you want to improve the sampling, do you want to completely forget important sampling and then something else?
I like it.
Optimize B-hat. So what do you think?
In a sense, I like to optimize B-hat for myself, but others might like that one. So I'd like a better understanding of actually this diffusion process approximation. I'd actually like a better sort of understanding of what's going on here, why this works, and whether there's a... to me, this seems like a sort of first-order approximation to that. I wouldn't mind a second-order approximation or some better view of what's happening here. I mean, I know this is equivalent to this sort of coalescent kind of... this probability I was saying, that each gene's sort of equally likely to be involved in an event back, but that's not true. I'd like a better understanding of that would improve that, at least from my own point of view, but there could be bigger questions. I mean, there's other ways to do it, yeah.
So another question, well, it's about the data, micro data and your approach. You already have Monte Carlo. So why do maximum likelihood separately? So why not?
Yes, you could do a Bayesian kind of approach.
You can put it in
You could do a Bayesian kind of thing. Or you could adjust it so you're doing a whole surface is being returned by the likelihood function. Yes, you could run it under a theta naught. This is probably what you're referring to, and I've done this. You can run it you can run the whole thing under a theta naught, if you like, and then sort of use important sampling to return a whole likelihood surface at once. And it sort of works. Doesn't always work. Because if you move too far away from your theta naught, you end with nonsense. Yeah. Okay, thanks.